Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The late spring air hung heavy and humid over the spires of Bruges. A slight hint of breeze carried with it a tinge of salt from the open North Sea, 8 miles distant. Birds chirped and cawed, melding with the low hum of voices carried upward from the narrow streets. But it was strangely quiet. Bruges was a bustling city, a center of banking and commerce that drew visitors from all the great commercial centers of Europe. Voices normally called out prices and exchange rates in English, Low German, High German, Picard, Flemish, Tuscan, and Provençal. From London and Riga, Cologne and Bordeaux, Venice and Lisbon, merchants came to buy and sell and trade. But not today. Today, June 21st, 1467, the natives of Bruges and visitors from all over Flanders, northern France, Holland, Zealand, and far beyond all lined the streets. Quiet and respectful, dressed all in black, 20,000 people made surprisingly little noise as they waited. Waited for the remains of Philip the Good, Duke of Burgundy, Brabant, Limburg, and Luxembourg, and Count of Flanders, Artois, Franche-Comte, Namur, Hainaut, and Holland, the holder of all those titles and more besides, for his remains to make their way through the jam-packed streets of Bruges. Philip the Good had ruled these lands for 47 years and ruled them well. He had been powerful and rich, maybe the most powerful ruler in Europe. His complex machinations and labyrinthine plans elicited fearful responses in the corridors of power everywhere from Barcelona to Paris to Westminster. One voice called out from the courtyard of the Ducal Palace, echoing off the cobbles and slate roof tiles. Two by two, the voice called out the names of the mourners, reading from a long parchment roll. Citizens of Bruges, court servants and officials, ranging from secretaries and counselors to financial wizards and chamberlains. Then came four bishops and 22 abbots, 24 officers and sergeants at arms, and then the coffin, carried by the late Duke's personal archers, then 20 noblemen in long black robes, then the Duke's son and heir Charles the Bold, then Philip's many illegitimate sons. Absolute silence ruled Bruges' streets as they passed out of the Duke's palace. The thousands of mourners lining the procession's route stood completely still, saying not a word. The only thing moving was the funeral cortege. Waiting at the inn was the Church of Saint Donatien, made so hot by the 1,400 candles lit within that additional holes had to be punched in the windows to allow heat to escape. There was nothing humble about the Valois Dukes of Burgundy, of whom the greatest was Philip the Good. Their origins were royal, their lifestyle was opulent, and their ambitions towered above even the most voracious kings and nobles of the age. Even their deaths were magnificent in their own way. For 114 years, from 1363 to 1477, the Dukes of Burgundy were among the key players in European politics. And then, in the blink of an eye, they were gone. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, I'm Patrick Wyman. Welcome to another episode of Tides of History. Thanks for joining me. If we've learned anything over the past few weeks' episodes, it's that late medieval politics were unstable, chaotic, and frequently violent. Kings, nobles, cities, even peasants made claims to rights and then tried to enforce those rights. Weak or inept rulers created turbulence that echoed throughout the political system, radiating outward from the political center into open warfare out in the towns and the countryside. One wrong move could bring down a dynasty that had lasted for centuries. But despite all the potential pitfalls, this landscape also presented opportunities to those who were willing and able to grasp them. Nobody did that better in the late Middle Ages than the Valois Dukes of Burgundy. Beginning in the 1360s, they assembled a collection of territories that stretched from southern France to the shores of the North Sea. By gift, conquest, purchase, and deceit, they acquired a bewildering variety of counties, duchies, and towns. From 1463 to 1477, 114 years, four generations of Valois dukes pursued their limitless ambitions in France and the Holy Roman Empire. The combination of talent, resources, and ruthlessness made them some of the most formidable players in the late medieval political game. At various points, they controlled the government of France, made and unmade kings of England, and determined the outcome of the Hundred Years' War. They pushed forward massive reforms in the financial and administrative systems of their lands, everywhere from Holland and Flanders to Luxembourg and Burgundy itself. Their glittering court culture featured high fashion, the most chivalrous knights in Europe, and a stunning array of artistic talent. It was the envy of and model for the rest of the continent. But in the end, the dynasty's ambitions stretched just a bit too far. The rising state the dukes created couldn't continue rising forever, not without provoking a response from its fearful neighbors. One icy day in January of 1477, the Valois Dukes of Burgundy disappeared forever in a haze of gunpowder and blood. The story of the Valois Dukes of Burgundy ended on a battlefield. That's fitting because it also began on a battlefield. On the afternoon of September 18th, 1356, a French army commanded by King Jean II attacked a hungry, thirsty, vastly outnumbered force of English at Poitiers in central France. John II is known as Jean le Bon, John the Good, but unfortunately, King John wasn't particularly good at either ruling or fighting. The Battle of Poitiers was a disaster of epic proportions. Attacking uphill, trying to force their way into an entrenched English position fortified by hedges, ditches, and marshy ground, chivalrous French knights died by the 100,000. The heir to the French throne, the Dauphin, barely escaped the field with his life. As the 18-year-old Dauphin retreated, his father, King John, attacked with a body of fresh men-at-arms. It was a brutal, vicious fight. Quote, "Men trod in their guts and spat out their teeth. Many were cloven to the ground or lost their limbs while on their feet. Dying men fell in the blood of their companions and groaned under the weight of corpses until they gave out their last breath. The blood of serfs and princes flowed in one stream into the river." King John the Good struggled amid this carnage, surrounded by some of the greatest knights in France. One of those knights was a fiery 14-year-old named Philip, the youngest son of King John. Philip stood fast in the thick of battle, shouting encouragement, taking a wound in the process, and staying close to his father until the English finally overwhelmed them. John II surrendered, and so did the young Philip. In the process, Philip earned two things. First, a nickname, Hardi, meaning bold. Second, he earned his father King John's undying affection. From that moment on, Philip would always be the favorite. Always the bold teenager fighting back-to-back with his father the king amid the brutal slaughter of a medieval battlefield. When they were finally ransomed back from England several years later, King John went about carving out inheritances for each of his four sons. The eldest, Charles, would eventually become King Charles V. Louis, the second son, became Duke of Orléans and soon acquired an additional claim on the entire kingdom of Naples in Italy. The third son, John, was made Duke of Berry, and became one of the age's great patrons of art, architecture, and literature. For Philip the Bold, John the Good found something much better than all of that. Burgundy. Burgundy was a quasi-independent duchy in eastern France, right along the border with the Holy Roman Empire. It was wealthy and extensive, home to beautiful castles, rich vineyards, and chivalrous knights. Its duke had just died without a viable heir. Now, John the Good could have simply absorbed this territory back into France and pulled its revenues and benefits directly to the French crown. But John thought he could do one better for his favorite son. Philip the Bold and his heirs were given Burgundy in perpetuity. That meant John handed over all royal rights in Burgundy except basic fealty to the king. If that weren't enough, John made Philip the Bold royal lieutenant in a large stretch of the kingdom and named him first peer of France. At the age of 21, he was the most important, most powerful, and richest nobleman in France outside his brother Charles, the heir to the throne. On top of all that, Philip was already ruling the imperial county of Burgundy. Now, confusingly, Burgundy was divided into two parts. The duchy in the west, which was part of the Kingdom of France, and that was Philip the Bold's inheritance, and the county in the east, called Franche-Comte, which was the half of Burgundy that fell within the boundaries of the Holy Roman Empire. It wasn't part of France, and it wasn't John the Good's to give. Instead, Philip the Bold had lobbied the Holy Roman Emperor, a guy named Charles IV, to entrust him with the county, and this worked. The combination of the duchy and county of Burgundy formed a potent power base for Philip the Bold to begin his career. It was the beginning of something that would mark out the Dukes of Burgundy until the very end. their simultaneous status as peers of the realm in France, princes of the blood, and at the same time as substantial rulers within the Holy Roman Empire. For many nobles of that day and age, the two Burgundies and a key role as a French peer may have been enough. Not for Philip the Bold. As it happened, the same accident that had made Burgundy available for Philip, the untimely death of the heir to Burgundy, had also widowed a young girl by the name of Margaret of Mall. Margaret of Mall was the daughter and only child of a guy named Louis of Mall. Louis of Mall was the Count of Flanders. When Louis eventually died, Margaret of Mall would be his sole heiress and the most eligible bachelorette in Europe. With the death of her first husband, this meant that whoever married young Margaret of Mall stood to inherit the single richest region of northwestern Europe. Louis of Mall's initial plan was to marry Margaret off to Edmund of Langley, one of the many sons of King Edward III of England. This made sense. Flanders was closely tied to England economically. But Flanders was politically part of the Kingdom of France, and there was no way the new King of France, Charles V, the son of John the Good, was going to allow the son of an enemy king to inherit Flanders. Philip the Bold had yet to marry, and he was his brother Charles's most effective and most trusted associate. Whatever Louis of Mall wanted, Charles V and Philip the Bold had other plans. It took several years of lobbying and actually bribing Louis of Mall's fierce mother to publicly berate her son to get him to agree to the match, but eventually, Margaret of Mall married Philip the Bold. The inheritance that Margaret of Mall united with the territories that Philip already had made the Duke of Burgundy the richest and most powerful non-king in Europe. On top of Flanders, Franche-Comte, and Burgundy, this territory included the counties of Artois and Rethel in northern France and Nevers in Burgundy. It was the single largest and wealthiest block of territory within the kingdom. The revenues and resources alone made Philip the Bold a force to be reckoned with. But that wasn't all that Philip the Bold did. He was an active participant in the Hundred Years' War, and he was his brother Charles's most important ally and subordinate. Despite his teenaged reputation on the battlefield, he was less comfortable as a soldier than as a diplomat and politician. Philip spent his entire life honing those skills. When Philip's brother Charles V died in 1380, and his 11-year-old son Charles VI became king, the royal uncles became the leading figures in France. Philip was the most prominent among them. His control of government was only briefly interrupted over the next 24 years. Now, Philip the Bold filled that role reasonably well. Among other things, he raised armies and fought the English. But, on top of that, he never lost sight of his own goals as Duke of Burgundy. When he made war, for example, Philip made sure that he was handsomely paid for his efforts. Those efforts also happened to be strongest when the English actively threatened Philip's own private interests, as when they invaded Philip's county of Flanders in 1383. King Charles VI eventually came of age, but he'd only ruled in his own right for a few years when he was struck by his first bout of mental illness. From this first incident in 1392 until his death in 1404, Philip the Bold basically did whatever he wanted, and he was rarely challenged. Philip routinely directed huge sums of money from royal coffers into his own pockets. Pensions, subsidies, and straight-up graft all enriched the Duke of Burgundy at the expense of the royal treasury. This stream of money funded Philip's extensive ambitions elsewhere, namely his machinations toward grabbing more territory. The financial system Philip built in his own lands was underpinned by tax money he diverted from France. Although he maintained a firm grip on French government during Charles VI's increasingly frequent bouts of mental illness, Philip did have one important challenger, Louis, Duke of Orléans, Philip's nephew and the brother of Charles VI. Philip the Bold and Louis of Orléans were effectively factional leaders within France. When Philip died in 1404, Louis moved quickly to seize the reins of power for himself and cut out the Burgundian faction. The new Duke of Burgundy, the eldest son of Philip the Bold, was a smart, capable 30-year-old named John the Fearless. John had every ounce of his father's limitless ambition and the same unscrupulous approach to racking up streams of income and lands. Ruthlessness was another trait they shared in common, but John the Fearless had more violent leanings. He was much more comfortable and capable as a military leader than his father had been. Where Philip had pulled diplomatic strings and engaged in endless rounds of negotiation, John the Fearless was more willing to take direct action. John inherited leadership of the Burgundian faction within France, and that was the central concern for most of his life and rule. The historian Richard Vaughan summed up his policy like this, quote, "In France, John simply followed the policy of his father. to try to maintain influence and control in order to protect his own interests and exploit French resources and the French Connection for his own advancement. That meant controlling the king, dominating him, and using him under the guise of obedience and loyalty to the poor, mentally ill Charles VI. In fairness, the alternative faction of Louis of Orléans didn't have anything more noble or altruistic in mind. This was a factional contest over the rewards that royal government could provide. Both Louis of Orléans and John the Fearless thought they had the right to exercise royal power. This was a lot like the later conflict in England that produced the Wars of the Roses, but the parties involved were much, much more powerful in their own right. While he'd been alive, the power, prestige, and political skill of Philip the Bold had held off open conflict within France. After his death, the situation deteriorated literally overnight. It took Louis of Orléans less than a month to completely cut out the Burgundians. Within a year, the realm was on the cusp of open war. By 1407, the situation had become completely untenable. Without French government money, the Dukes of Burgundy were on the cusp of financial ruin. In 1403 to 1404, Philip the Bold had secured 188,600 francs in pensions and gifts from the crown. In 1406 to 7, John the Fearless got 2,000 francs. To make matters worse, Louis of Orléans was forming alliances with John's enemies and meddling in the affairs of the Duke's younger brother and close ally, Anton, the Duke of Brabant. With financial and political disaster in sight, John the Fearless found a solution that was both easy and incredibly destabilizing. On Wednesday, November 23, 1407, Louis of Orléans was riding home through the streets of Paris, accompanied by a small group of servants. As he traveled, eight masked men emerged from a house where they'd been hidden for a week, waiting for their opportunity. Surrounding Louis, they pulled him off his horse and brutally attacked him. His hand was completely severed, and his head was cleaved in two with an axe. The next day, Louis's servants collected what was left of their master and brought him to a church. There to mourn his death were the Dukes of Anjou, Berry, and Bourbon, the most important men in the kingdom. John the Fearless, the man who had ordered the assassination, was there as well. Cool as a cucumber, bowing his head in solemn prayer, giving no sign that he was responsible for the deed. Of course, it didn't take much to figure out that John the Fearless was the perpetrator, but by that point, it didn't matter. With Louis of Orléans out of the way, John the Fearless and the Burgundian faction controlled France until 1413. They didn't do so without opposition. Louis's faction, now led by the Count of Armagnac, was still around. The balance of power shifted back toward the Armagnacs, as they were now called, in 1413. When the great warrior king Henry V of England invaded in 1415, John the Fearless mostly stayed out of it. He avoided the disastrous Battle of Agincourt, though both of his younger brothers actually died there. Afterward, when it became clear that Henry V was the rising power and the Armagnacs were in deep trouble, John threw in his lot with the King of England. As Henry V conquered Normandy in the summer of 1417, John the Fearless invaded northern France. He took Paris in 1418 and executed every Armagnac he could find, including their leader, the Count of Armagnac himself. At this point, John the Fearless was a European ruler in all but title. He controlled vast lands in his own right. When he held sway over the government of France, his personal resources were equal to any crowned king in Europe. But as his career progressed, the Duke of Burgundy became more and more consumed by the struggle within France. That would soon be his undoing. In 1419, the fourth son of poor, mentally ill King Charles VI had taken over as heir to the throne following the death of his brother. This new Dauphin, heir, also named Charles, was for the moment the enemy of John the Fearless. Charles was allied to the Armagnacs, and he had fled Paris when John took the city in 1418. Dauphin Charles, though, was now attempting a reconciliation. John was receptive. The Dauphin didn't have to be his enemy. In fact, the Dauphin could be a useful tool for further controlling the government of France. The two sides negotiated productively through the early months of 1419. They met in person with good results. Finally, Dauphin Charles suggested another in-person meeting on the bridge of Montereau, some 45 miles southeast of Paris. John the Fearless was wary and hesitant, but Charles's ambassadors convinced him of his good faith. They convinced him to go. On September 10th, 1419, John the Fearless and 10 companions made their way down to the bridge at Montereau from the castle where they'd been staying. 10 was very few companions for the Duke of Burgundy, but that was the number that he and Charles had agreed on. waiting for them on the other side of a hastily constructed wooden wall with a 16-year-old Dauphin and his 10 companions. A wooden gate, manned by the Dauphin's men, creaked closed behind them. Jean advanced toward the Dauphin and knelt before him. As he knelt, a man leaned in toward the Dauphin and whispered something to him. That was the signal. At that moment, another of the Dauphin's men produced an axe and struck Jean the Fearless. "Kill! Kill!" somebody yelled. Another of the Dauphin's men cut Jean's face with a sword. A second blow from the axe dropped the Duke to the ground, caving in the side of his skull. As the dying Duke lay prone on the ground, a sword thrust to the chest finished him off. This was a carefully premeditated and minutely planned assassination. The Dauphin Charles had lured John the Fearless to the perfect spot, made sure he was cut off from any potential help, and then personally seen that the deed was done. John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy, was dead.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The horse's flanks were stained with sweat and caked with the mud of the late summer roads of Flanders. Their breathing was strained and labored, audible over the sound of their tack clanking and their hooves on the cobbled streets of Ghent. The messengers who rode them were exhausted, barely awake in the saddle. They had covered more than 200 miles in just 3 days, riding hard from the city of Troyes with important news. Duke John the Fearless had died at the bridge of Montereau. The messengers passed through the narrow, crowded streets of Ghent. Waiting for them was a tall, slim, tanned 23-year-old who shared his father's long, prominent nose and expressive eyes. Keen intelligence lurked behind this rather ordinary face. The young man's name was Philip, and he was currently the Count of Charolais. Now that his father, John the Fearless, was dead, Philip, soon to be known as Philip the Good, was Duke of Burgundy. Philip took the news of his father's assassination hard. He gnashed his teeth and rolled his eyes in grief, according to the court chronicler George Chastelain, and it took him the better part of a week to recover enough to conduct official business. But when he did, Duke Philip attacked the complex problems he faced with intelligence and skill. Of all the Dukes of Burgundy, Philip the Good was probably the most gifted politician. Quote, a political mind surrounded by political minds, in the words of the historian Yvon Lacaze. Philip had a gift for seeing all the potential angles, for picking out obscure threads of opportunity and weaving them into a web of advantage for his own interests. His father, John the Fearless, had been a talented soldier. Philip the Good never particularly wanted to be on the battlefield. In 1420, for example, he wrote that he was, quote, as yet but slightly equipped with martial valor. Despite that, Philip turned out to be an infinitely more effective ruler. Philip's time as Duke was the golden age of Burgundy, a time of glittering court culture, territorial expansion, and administrative efficiency. He was one of the two or three most powerful men in Europe, a king in all but name. Philip's rule began with the 23-year-old Duke coming to a key realization that his father had been drastically overcommitted to French affairs, and that was what had gotten him killed. The Dukes of Burgundy were French princes. That hadn't changed. But there were plenty of French princes who didn't spend every waking hour trying to direct the kingdom's affairs. Philip the Bold had bled royal coffers to fund his ambitions. John the Fearless had struggled to control France itself, as much for the sake of doing so as for any material advantage. Whatever the Dukes of Burgundy could gain from France in 1419 was far outweighed by what it would cost, and Philip the Good grasped that very quickly. On top of the basic realpolitik at play, there was the matter of temperament and upbringing. Unlike his father and grandfather, Philip the Good had mostly been raised outside the core territories of France. He was a stranger to the French court. He was much more comfortable in Bruges or Ghent than in Paris. as we'll see, Philip the Good would still play an important role in French politics, but he never, ever lost sight of his many other interests. There were plenty of opportunities for an ambitious duke outside the chaotic and violent world of a France racked by the Hundred Years' War. But at least at the beginning, that conflict still required Philip's attention. The obvious solution was to extend his father's alliance with the English and their king, Henry V. This led directly to the Treaty of Troyes in 1420, less than a year after the murder of John the Fearless. The Dauphin Charles was disinherited in favor of Henry V and his heirs, and Paris was handed over to the English king. At this point, the Kingdom of France was effectively divided into three parts. The North and Normandy, ruled by Henry V, the South, which largely belonged to the Dauphin and his allies, and the Northeast, Picardy and Champagne, which were under Burgundian control. Henry V wanted to conquer the Dauphin's territories and rule France. That was just fine with Philip the Good, particularly if that English alliance kept his own lands and interests safe. To cement the alliance, Philip married his sister Margaret to John, Duke of Bedford, the brother of Henry V and his most trusted ally. After the death of Henry V in 1422, the Duke of Bedford basically ruled the English portion of France as regent for his nephew, the infant King Henry VI. All of this meant that Philip had a personal tie to the man who controlled the English in France. But despite that, Philip had no interest in an all-out war with the Dauphin Charles, and he never pursued one. His campaigns were mostly small-scale, like the mere 1,000 men he assembled in 1421. When he agreed to a larger military endeavor with the English, it was either because his own lands were directly threatened, as in 1422, or because he made sure that the English paid handsomely for his aid. As the English position deteriorated, the amounts of money involved got larger and larger. Philip was owed £150,000 by 1431, several times the English crown's annual income. He collected a monthly pension on top of that. When the cash wasn't there, Philip was happy to be paid in territory. The English officially transferred a number of towns and counties to him in return for his continuing aid. One notable piece of that aid was the capture of Joan of Arc by Burgundian forces in 1431, who then handed her over to the English to be tried and burned at the stake. All in all, the English needed Philip the Good far more than Philip the Good needed the English. With that in mind, it was really only a matter of time until their interests eventually diverged. As early as the late 1420s, King Charles VII of France, the former Dauphin, was making overtures to Philip the Good about a rapprochement. That manifested in local truces between French and Burgundian forces and productive, ongoing negotiations. What held the two sides back from full reconciliation was mostly the emotional aspects of the conflict between Philip the Good and Charles VII, rather than any purely material concern. This was something we talked about in the last episode, on civil wars and political breakdowns, but it's worth repeating here. Politics was personal. It was about relationships between people, albeit people embedded in larger structures and institutions. Philip the Good wasn't just going to get over the fact that the now King of France had assassinated his father in the coldest of blood. It would take time and a lot of money. The question was just how long that was going to take and just how much Philip was going to extract in concessions from Charles VII. It would be a mistake to say that the eventual agreement simply put a capstone on an already existing situation of peace. Philip the Good actively campaigned against Charles VII between 1431 and 1434, for example. But finally, in September of 1435, 16 years after the assassination of John the Fearless, the two sides agreed on a long-term peace deal. This was called the Treaty of Arras, and it was hugely significant. It confirmed Philip's possession of a bunch of valuable territories, mostly in what's now northern France, all the way from the coast to the Somme River. In addition, the treaty stipulated that Philip the Good would be exempt from doing homage to Charles VII. Finally, it said that Charles accepted responsibility for the death of John the Fearless. In return, Philip acknowledged Charles VII as King of France in place of the English King Henry VI. From this point on, English rule in France could only go downhill. That does not mean that Charles VII and Philip the Good turn into best friends overnight. Very much the opposite. Charles VII had bought off Philip's key advisors and even his wife to convince the Duke to agree to the Treaty of Arras in the first place, which gives some sense for how convincing the actual arguments were. We talked a bit about Charles VII last time. He was the one who hated his son and heir, who eventually became King Louis XI. Charles was above all a survivor and an incredibly cool customer, if not a particularly forceful ruler. He had very calmly stood by as he pulled John the Fearless into his trap. He weathered decades of English preeminence in France, and he waited for his opportunity to regain the upper hand. He wasn't going to simply let Philip the Good waltz off with big chunks of territory and prestige. Tensions remained high for decades afterward. French soldiers raided Philip's territory. French pirates attacked Flemish shipping with the tacit approval of the crown. Charles VII intruded into Burgundian interests in the Holy Roman Empire. For his part, Philip was happy to make alliances with the other powerful princes of France against Charles VII. Open war between Philip and Charles VII was only narrowly averted in 1445, and that wasn't the only close brush. The relationship between France and Burgundy is one strand of Philip the Good's story, but it's not the only or even the most important one. Even as he was busily politicking with Henry V, the Duke of Bedford, and Charles VII, Philip was also much more actively pursuing a separate set of interests in the Netherlands. He already held Flanders, which was basically the northwestern chunk of present-day Belgium, centered on Bruges and Ghent. What interested him was the band of territory to the north and east of that, the modern-day Netherlands, western Belgium, and Luxembourg. This was a patchwork of counties and lordships and independent cities, most of them pretty small, and many of them technically part of the Holy Roman Empire. The precise circumstances in these territories made them extremely vulnerable to takeover by a wealthy, powerful ruler like Philip the Good. The princes of these lands were perpetually broke, unable to keep up with the increasing cost and scale of warfare in this period. The dynasties that ruled here were also running out of legitimate heirs. This left an opening for someone, Philip the Good maybe, to come in and make a claim on the territory. What made that a viable possibility for Philip was the fact that these territories generally had powerful representative institutions. Now, these representative institutions weren't democratic in any meaningful sense. They mostly represented the interests of nobles, the clergy, and especially urban elites. Entrepreneurs, merchants, patricians, and magistrates, those types of folks. For those people, the rising urban elites, the rule of the Duke of Burgundy was an attractive proposition. He could offer them law and order to protect their business interests, something that was lacking under perpetually penniless small-time rulers. Philip the Good also wasn't the type to engage in follies. This was important because for the subjects of these territories, princely debts were public and not private responsibilities. On top of that, everybody knew that Philip was monstrously rich. Philip offered commercial connections, first and foremost with wealthy Flanders, the economic heartland of the region, but also with England, France, the cities of the Rhineland, and further beyond that by means of trade treaties. The Duke of Burgundy could open commercial channels that lesser rulers simply couldn't. All of this made the representative institutions receptive to Philip the Good's overtures. There was a confluence of interests. Philip wanted the territory, and subjects wanted what he could offer. So, when Philip the Good came knocking at the door of a count or lord whose coffers were empty, who had been squeezing his subjects for tax revenue to pay off unpayable debts, he knew what kind of leverage he had. Over and over again, Philip repeated this pattern. First up was Namur, a small and sparsely settled territory southwest of Brussels in what's now Belgium. Philip the Good simply bought the rights to inherit the county from its lord in 1421. The representative body there approved it, and Philip took over Namur when its ruler died 8 years later. The second one was much more complicated. Philip wanted the triple county of Hainaut, Holland, and Zeeland. This was a much bigger chunk of territory. The western half of the modern Netherlands, from Vlissingen up past Amsterdam, and the piece of what's now central Belgium centered on the city of Mons. There was a complicated history here that included a double marriage between the family of the Dukes of Burgundy and the ruling House of Bavaria. When the Bavarian claimant to these lands died in 1425, the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund, remember him from our Vlad the Impaler episode, thought those lands should come back to him. It took a great deal of maneuvering, some minor military confrontations, and a huge amount of money to eventually confirm Philip the Good as ruler. His succession in the Duchy of Brabant, basically the modern southern Netherlands and central Belgium from Breda to Antwerp to Brussels, well, that was complicated too. That one required another substantial payment. His final major acquisition was the Duchy of Luxembourg, which more or less corresponds to the modern country of that name. This was likewise a purchase from its deeply indebted current ruler. But unlike elsewhere, the people of the duchy weren't precisely happy to see Philip the Good take over. It took a battle to convince them otherwise, and even then, Philip couldn't take formal possession of the duchy for some time. The upshot of all this politicking and buying and negotiating was a huge increase in the territory and resources controlled by Philip the Bold. He ruled a huge band of territory stretching from the North Sea through Belgium and the Netherlands down to Luxembourg, and then the Duchy of Burgundy and Franche-Comte, bordering what's now Switzerland. There were still a few territorial gaps where it was broken by independent pieces of territory, like the city of Liège and the Duchy of Lorraine, but it was a pretty coherent block of land. Moreover, this band of territory included the wealthiest parts of Northern Europe. So how should we understand this patchwork of territories? What exactly did Philip the Good actually rule? The best concept here is what a few historians have deemed a quote-unquote composite monarchy. This is a term that we'll be coming back to again and again over the next couple of episodes because it's the most common political form in early modern Europe. In essence, a composite monarchy is when a single ruler or dynasty controls multiple territories, each of which retains its own traditions and customs. The ruler's basis for control is different for each of those territories. What made a ruler duke of one territory was not connected to what made him count of another or margrave of a third. Each was separate and was ruled separately. In popular media, you sometimes hear long lists of titles for rulers of this period. Duke of this, count of that, king of this other thing, and so on. It's funny and it's easy to parody, but it reflects an underlying historical reality. Each of those titles represented a different claim to rights of rulership. The level of central control and administration could vary widely in a composite state. The Ottoman Empire was a composite state, for example, but it had a strong standing army and central fiscal administration. The same wasn't true of the kings of the combined Poland-Lithuania. The Dukes of Burgundy may not have had a royal title, but they were the quintessential composite monarchs. Each of their territories retained independent rights and engaged in a great deal of self-governance. That's not to say that nothing changed when the Dukes of Burgundy took over. Very much the opposite. When the dukes acquired new lands, the existing princely courts and households of their new territories dissolved. That was a hugely significant event. The court of the Duke of Namur or the Count of Holland had been the natural center of power. It had been a political, social, cultural hub for the territory its ruler controlled. What replaced the princely court was a new administrative council composed of key elites, nobles and urban patricians, led by a provincial governor appointed by the duke. Competence and loyalty were the key factors that determined who would get those jobs. University-educated experts in law and financial administration largely replaced the old feudal aristocracy as the duke's subordinates. This wasn't exactly a meritocracy. Patronage counted for a great deal. But this was a much more rational, bureaucratic, administrative approach to governing than what it replaced. It also wasn't a top-down system. There was plenty of dialogue between rulers and ruled, namely their representative institutions. Tensions existed, but by and large, Burgundian rule was smooth and not deeply resented. At the center of it all was the court of the Duke of Burgundy himself, the glittering household of one of the richest and most powerful men in Europe. By the end of his life in 1467, Philip the Good's annual revenues were probably higher than those of any other European ruler, except maybe the King of France, and even that's arguable. Philip patronized the greatest artists of the day, painters of the early Northern Renaissance like Jan van Eyck. The Order of Chivalry he founded, the Order of the Golden Fleece, was the most fashionable and well-connected in Europe. His court, which consisted of hundreds of permanent employees and far more hangers-on, that set the tone for the rest of Europe. Its ornate ceremonies and rituals had a long afterlife as trendsetters for the political life of the early modern period. Philip the Good's Burgundy was a monument to what ambitious, resourceful, and intelligent rulers could do in late medieval Europe. But it couldn't last forever.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Among his many talents, Philip the Good was a prolific womanizer. He produced at least 10 and possibly as many as 30 illegitimate children while maintaining dozens of mistresses. But he had only one legitimate son, Charles the Bold, who would inherit both all his father's vast domains and his burning ambition for more. More lands, more titles, more money, and a greater reputation. That ambition defined Charles's eventful career and ensured that it was going to end spectacularly, one way or the other. Now, we've already met Charles the Bold here on Tides. He was King Louis XI of France's chief antagonist during the War of the Public Weal from 1465 on. That was while Charles was still Count of Charolais and heir to Philip the Good, before his father's death. It was a sign of just how far Charles planned to push the envelope of Burgundian power, and the kinds of frictions that were bound to exist between the greatest French prince of the blood and the King of France. That conflict would define Charles's life and the course of politics from 1465 on. When he took over from his father in 1467, Charles the Bold was an angry and humorless 33-year-old, intelligent, handsome, and decisive. What he took over was one of the strongest and richest political units in Europe, something that was very nearly an independent kingdom in its own right. But there was also a deep structural tension here, the disconnect between the Duke of Burgundy's independent power and his simultaneous status as a vassal of the King of France for some of his most important territories. When you combined that structural tension with the personalities of the political actors involved, it was a volatile mixture. Louis XI of France was wily and dangerous and never stopped playing the game. Charles the Bold wanted more, more, more. That dynamic, the deep-seated conflict between two rising states and their rulers, was bound to end in violence. So even before Charles the Bold took over from his father as Duke of Burgundy, we've seen how he and Louis XI came into conflict. The War of the Public Weal was an attempt by a collection of French princes to limit the power of Louis XI. Charles the Bold was the ringleader here, but the alliance also included the more or less independent Duke of Brittany, the Duke of Bourbon, and a whole bunch of other nobles. It did succeed in cutting Louis down to size, at least for the moment, but not enough to turn royal power into the irrelevance that Charles wanted it to become. Charles and Louis were probably always going to be enemies. Their interests were just too conflicting. But the War of the Public Weal all but guaranteed the two would be foes to the end. From 1465 to 1472, war constantly threatened to break out between the two, mostly over the status of a bunch of rich and important towns located along the River Somme in northern France. Things got bad enough that Louis declared all of Charles's French possessions forfeit to the crown in 1470, but the king pretty obviously couldn't make good on that declaration. Even after 1472, when the two sides were technically at peace, Louis was an active player in trying to thwart Charles's ambitions outside France. He supported the inhabitants of Liège and Guelders in their efforts against Charles, which we'll talk about shortly. This was a zero-sum game. What was good for Charles and Burgundy was bad for France, and vice versa. Both Charles and Louis understood that. But Charles's ambitions also extended well outside France. In fact, aside from the disputed Somme towns and the natural clash with Louis XI, he really had pretty little interest in the kingdom that had produced his dynasty. Most of Charles's attention was turned to the east, toward the confusing patchwork of territories that lay along what's now the border between France, Germany, and Switzerland. This was his major concern throughout his life, and it's what led directly to his death. To understand why, we have to grasp the shape of Burgundian territory in the 1460s. It consisted of two separate blocks. First, the northern one, which covered pieces of northern France, Flanders, Hainaut, Brabant, Holland, and Luxembourg. Aside from a thin strip of territory that belonged to the city of Liège and what's now eastern Belgium, this block was basically continuous and coherent. To the east of it lay the Rhine River and other territories of the Holy Roman Empire. The second block was the southern one, and it consisted of the Duchy of Burgundy and Franche-Comte. These territories were right next door to each other, and they too were coherent. Between those two, between the northern end of Franche-Comte and the southern piece of Luxembourg, were the territories of the Duke of Lorraine and the rich cities of the Rhine River corridor. These were important and independent-minded places like Strasbourg, Cologne, and Metz, centers of trade and finance. Charles had one real goal that he pursued opportunistically throughout his life: to extend his power east toward the Rhine, taking advantage of openings wherever he saw them. There was nothing stopping him from going anywhere else, but east was where the advantages pretty clearly lay at this time. He may also have intended to join up his two separate chunks of territory into one coherent and unbroken block that stretched from what's now Switzerland to the North Sea. Philip the Good had been a savvy and slippery diplomat, a guy who preferred backroom dealing and money to raw force whenever possible. Now, Charles wasn't averse to diplomacy. Envoys were constantly coming and going from his household, to the court of Louis XI, to the Duke of Brittany, to the King of England, to the Holy Roman Emperor, to the Duke of Milan, to Savoy, to the Swiss towns, basically anywhere else you can think of. But unlike his father, Charles was a soldier at heart. The Duke invested huge amounts of time and money in his armies, more than any other contemporary ruler. Once he'd planned and invested in those armies, he wanted to use them, and he did. Charles the Bold's first target was the city of Liège. Like many cities in this region, Liège was ruled by a prince/bishop who was both religious leader and temporal ruler. The city also controlled a substantial surrounding territory. That chunk of territory happened to separate the northern Burgundian territories from the Duchy of Luxembourg. On top of that, the city had been a thorn in the side of the Duke of Burgundy for many years. Burgundian merchants were unwelcome there, the city wouldn't take Burgundian currency, and the city's inhabitants plotted with the enemies of Burgundy, especially Louis XI of France. Between 1465 and 1468, Charles led three separate campaigns against Liège. In the last one, his soldiers captured and brutally sacked the city. After that, Liège and its surrounding territory were basically under Burgundian control. Next up was the Duchy of Guelders, a collection of lands situated around the point where the Rhine River breaks up into its branches and heads toward the North Sea. It included towns like Zutphen, Arnhem, and Nijmegen, all around what's now the border between Germany and the Netherlands. Philip the Good had his eyes on Guelders his whole life and consistently looked for opportunities to insert himself into its affairs. Charles the Bold took that a step further. He intervened in a really nasty dispute between the current duke and his son. He took the son captive and sent an army to help the father, and eventually he simply purchased the rights to the duchy. The inhabitants weren't especially happy about this, though. The town of Nijmegen in particular was determined to resist. This did not end well for them. Nijmegen fell in 1473, and the rest of the duchy surrendered after. It would remain under military occupation for several years to come. Now, neither the conquests of Liège nor Guelders was a sign of particularly overmighty ambition on Charles the Bold's part. He had laid really careful groundwork for intervention, he took his time, and then acted forcefully when the opportunity presented itself. These were part of a broader plan for Charles the Bold to further move himself into the affairs of the Holy Roman Empire. The politics of the empire were complex. There were so many moving pieces, so many players, so many different claims to rights that it's really hard to keep track of them all, let alone fit them into a straightforward narrative. Charles the Bold was already a prince of the empire by virtue of holding Franche-Comte and then taking Guelders, which was imperial territory. The lands he coveted along the Rhine belonged to the empire as well. In the borderlands where the Kingdom of France met the empire, there were opportunities and pitfalls alike for ambitious lords like Charles the Bold. From 1469 on, Charles pursued these openings wherever he could find them. Alsace was a collection of lands straddling the upper reaches of the Rhine River, right along the linguistic boundary between German and French to the north of Switzerland. Charles purchased rights here from Duke Sigismund of Austria, the brother of the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick III. Whether Sigismund was deeply in debt and needed ready cash, or he simply couldn't afford to defend these lands, Charles was happy to take advantage. Alsace was potentially rich, with major towns, rich agricultural land, and even some silver mines. Unfortunately for Charles, Alsace proved to be a pain for two reasons. First, because it was difficult to administer, which was made worse by a really poor choice of subordinate in the region. And second, because it brought him into direct conflict with the aggressive Swiss. Charles's second major attempted acquisition was the Duchy of Lorraine. Lorraine lay between the two major blocks of Burgundian territory, and grabbing it would more or less unite the two in a single unbroken chain. At first, Charles's diplomacy got him a great deal of what he wanted in Lorraine: rites of passage for himself and his soldiers, open lines of communication, and control of some fortified places. After a while, though, problems between Duke René of Lorraine and Charles the Bold led to open conflict. Charles would have to fight for Lorraine, and Alsace II in the bargain. These were much greater ambitions than Liège and Guelders. Charles the Bold was a really interesting military innovator in a period where new technologies and techniques were transforming warfare. He believed in gunpowder and professionalism, things that would point the way toward the future. In fact, a lot of Charles the Bold's posthumous renown has to do with his military policies. Even before he was Duke, when he was fighting Louis XI during the War of the Public Weal, he invested heavily in gunpowder artillery. After he succeeded his father, Charles issued a series of military ordinances between 1468 and 1473. These ordinances established a permanent standing army. Now, standing armies were a rarity at this point. They were hard to assemble and they were even harder to pay for. Only France and the Ottomans had one of any size. The Wars of the Roses, for example, were fought with semi-feudal contract armies. Companies of mercenaries flitted from employer to employer in Italy. Well, these were semi-permanent bodies of troops, and their contracts could last for years at a time. Charles the Bold's military ordinances and his general approach to war were the work of a keen observer of military trends. His permanent army was comprised of heavily armored men-at-arms on horseback, the shock troops of any army in this period. He also maintained archers and handgunners, along with some pikemen. They were the core of Charles's army. On top of that, though, he hired others. The Italian mercenaries, condottieri, were on the cutting edge of military practice. Charles hired them in large numbers, and he paid them well. English longbowmen had dominated battlefields in the Hundred Years' War. Charles hired them, too. Artillery battered town and castle walls. Charles bought the finest guns in Europe. The combination of permanent troops paid for by taxation and elite mercenaries made Charles a military force to be reckoned with. On top of that, he could still call in more traditional military reserves, the remnants of the old feudal order. Military historians have lauded Charles as a forward-looking innovator, and that's a reputation he deserves. But, as we've talked about here many times on Tides, war was expensive. Paying for standing armies and cutting-edge mercenaries meant footing war costs on a permanent basis, and even the impossibly wealthy Duke of Burgundy struggled with that. Charles called for new taxes regularly, hitting even the normally exempt clergy in 1474. He was nearly bankrupt in 1475 and had to pawn his jewels and personal possessions to pay his army. Loans weren't forthcoming, even from his subjects, the wealthy merchant bankers of Antwerp, Brussels, and Bruges. State formation was an impossibly expensive process, and Charles the Bold was running out of cash. That happened at the worst possible time. Charles had proceeded slowly and methodically for the first 7 years of his reign, from 1467 to 1474. He made a purchase here and laid some groundwork there. He tried to acquire a royal crown from the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick III, but those negotiations fell through. He fought Louis XI and made peace with him. He made alliances with other French princes. He acquired some territory. By 1475, Charles had concluded a major alliance with his brother-in-law, King Edward IV of England, for a joint invasion of France. But it came to nothing. Louis paid off Edward handsomely, and Charles found other things to be concerned with. In 1475, in the next 2 years, Charles's major concern was his attempted acquisition of Alsace and Lorraine. This was a much more serious endeavor than anything he'd tried before. I mentioned just how much of a political minefield the Holy Roman Empire was. The cities of the Rhine corridor, like Strasbourg and Cologne, were powerful and independent. They weren't happy about having an ambitious new neighbor like Charles the Bold. The Swiss Confederation, the collection of towns led by Bern, was technically part of the empire too, but it was effectively independent. Now, the Swiss were hardly shrinking violets. They were expanding too, and their interests in Alsace abutted Charles's new territory. The Swiss also happened to be quite receptive to diplomatic overtures from Louis XI. In the most extreme version of this story, Louis XI wove a web of aggressive alliances around his enemy, Charles the Bold, that eventually captured the Duke like a fly in a spider's web. In the more realistic version, Louis simply nudged the Swiss and the Holy Roman Emperor and the independent cities in the direction they were already moving, a formal alliance against Charles the Bold. Either way, the end result was an explosive situation. There was no chance that the outwardly mobile Swiss were simply going to let Charles expand into Alsace, that the imperial cities of the Rhineland would allow him free reign, or that the Duke of Lorraine would give up his lands. Open war was coming. An alliance of the Swiss, the Duke of Lorraine, and these cities rose up against Charles. By 1475, though, Charles's reputation as a military leader seemed cemented. He had failed in one siege, but took the entirety of Lorraine by December. only a motley assortment of enemies remain. Towns like Bern, Strasbourg, Basel, and rural communities like Uri and Schweiz in Switzerland, the humiliated Duke of Lorraine, and the Duke of Austria, who wasn't going to offer much help. Charles took the field early in 1476, confident of victory, leading his new model army. Charles's first target was the castle of Grandson in what's now western Switzerland. It was garrisoned by Swiss troops who quickly surrendered when besieged by Charles's heavy cannon. The Duke ordered them all executed and left their bodies hanging from trees around the castle. What Charles hadn't expected was the speed of the Swiss relief force. Armed with pikes and halberds, practically all on foot, the Swiss came on the Burgundian army with shocking quickness. His troops fled, and Charles the Bold lost most of his artillery and his baggage train. It was a humiliating defeat, but much worse was to come. Charles recovered, gathered another army, and continued his plans to humble the Swiss. He invaded Swiss territory, heading for the small but well-fortified city of Murten, or Murat, about 20 miles from Bern, the center of Swiss resistance. Once again, disaster struck. Charles was expecting a Swiss attack, and he drew up his army in a defensive formation. But then he allowed them to leave their lines to get paid. With only a skeleton crew holding the Burgundian defenses, the Swiss and their allies from Lorraine charged with shocking speed. Once again, the Burgundians were put to flight. But this time, thousands of them died as they were fleeing the battle. Where Grandson had been a setback, Murten was a disaster. What was worse was that Charles didn't really realize it. If anything, the defeat made him more confident in himself as a military leader, more determined to prove himself and end things on the battlefield. Charles had been heavily outnumbered in both of these defeats. The Swiss were fighting close to home, just miles away, and their soldiers were short-term militia rather than a standing army. They didn't have to worry about logistics in the same way as the strategy-obsessed Duke. That theme of fighting against serious odds showed up yet again in the final act of Charles's career. It was the fall of 1476. Charles had faced two serious defeats, but he wasn't ready to give up just yet. He simply gathered more troops and set about properly reinvading Lorraine, which had risen up against him after his battlefield setbacks. He did well at first, but his army dwindled with the cold weather, disease, and lack of money. By December, Charles was besieging the small city of Nancy with a paper force of some 10,000 men. In reality, it was probably closer to 5,000. By the standards of the Hundred Years' War, this wasn't a tiny army. Henry V probably had around that number at Agincourt. But next to the forces the Swiss and their Lorrainer allies could gather just a couple of hundred miles from home, it was pitifully small. The Duke sent out letter after letter commanding reinforcements to join him from Luxembourg, but none arrived. He knew how precarious his situation was, but he refused to abandon the siege. Charles's stubbornness would be his undoing. As Charles besieged Nancy in the depths of a freezing December, a relief force led by Duke René of Lorraine and a motley collection of experienced Swiss mercenaries approached the city. Peasant lads from the hills outside Luzern and merchant sons raised in Bern, bristling with long pikes and wicked halberds, mixed with knights from Lorraine and artisans from Strasbourg. Together, they outnumbered Charles at least 2 and probably more like 3 or even 4 to 1. The Allies tramped up icy roads and reached the city on January 5, 1477. Snow fell in blinding flurries and gathered in great heaps under the leafless branches of the trees that surrounded Nancy. The Burgundians held a defensive position, their artillery covering the most likely approach. But they never saw the Allies' second column wheel through the forest and dead ground and emerge on their flank. Both Allied contingents outnumbered Charles the Bold's tiny army. The Allied front emerged directly opposite the Burgundian lines, appearing at close range through a forested front and the swirling snow. 3 long blasts of a horn marked their arrival. A small stream separated them from Charles the Bold's line. The icy water froze their toes as they splashed across, closing the gap at a quick trot, pikes and halberds at the ready. The Burgundian artillery had no time to get off more than a single volley of shots before they closed with shocking speed. The Burgundian front was already crumbling under the assault when the second column hit them from the side. The defeat turned into a general rout as the Burgundians fled the battlefield. Charles the Bold was among those fleeing. His party retreated along with the rest, but crossing a stream, the Duke fell. Lances pierced his belly and groin, but the final blow came from a halberd, almost certainly wielded by a Swiss mercenary, but split his head in 2.
thousands of his soldiers joined him in death, hemmed in by the garrison of Nancy and the attacking allies. Only a few ragged survivors, plagued by frostbite in their wounds, managed to struggle nearly 30 miles through the ice and snow to safety. Many more died of hunger and cold as they tried to make their escape. It took 2 days of searching to find Charles's body on the battlefield. It had been stripped of its jewels and its armor and chewed by wild animals. Only the scars of battle and its long fingernails identified the corpse as that of the former Duke of Burgundy. The Burgundian state died along with Charles on the battlefield of Nancy. He had only one child, a 19-year-old daughter named Mary, who would inherit all of her father's vast possessions. Whoever managed to marry her would acquire one of the richest domains in Europe. But that's a story for another day. Next week, in fact. The Valois Dukes of Burgundy rode their considerable talent and resources to the very limit of what was possible in late medieval politics. They acquired huge chunks of territory by inheritance, purchase, and outright conquest. When one talented duke followed another, he could build on his predecessor's accomplishments and follow generational opportunities for advancement. That was the strength of the dynastic model. But the dynasty was also its weakness. When Charles the Bold ate a Swiss halberd at Nancy, that was the end of 114 years of Valois rule. Their state disappeared almost overnight. Its legacy lived on in the institutions of rule they created, institutions that helped power the emergence of the Dutch Republic centuries later, in the court culture they bequeathed to the kings of early modern Europe, and in the ghost of what might have been another major kingdom, but for the rashness of Charles the Bold. Until next time, thank you so much for joining me. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design for this episode is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.